From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, show of support. President Barack Obama welcomes Ukraine's interim prime minister to the White House as the US defends Ukraine's sovereignty.
That meeting will, by itself, I think, demonstrate the fact that we strongly support the Ukrainian people. We strongly support Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty.
Day five and still no sign of the missing Malaysia Airlines flight as a vast search continues across the peninsula. And the Louisiana prisoner freed after nearly 30 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit.
Glenn Ford, who for the past three decades has been fighting literally for his life. How many people that have been executed in this country were actually innocent of the crime in which they were convicted?
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. An explosion in New York City has left at least two dead and 18 injured. Officials say a gas leak caused a building in the East Harlem neighborhood to blow up and collapse. Officials say a gas company was called to investigate shortly before the building exploded, and witnesses confirmed they smelled gas in the hours before the collapse. Emergency efforts continue as workers try to secure the area. Our correspondent Patrice Howard was on the scene.
At least two buildings here, both six or seven stories, have collapsed. New York City police and fire are on the scene. At least 39 units have responded from across the city. On the lower floors of this building were a piano shop and a church. Above, a residential building.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said this is a tragedy of the worst kind and lauded the efforts of first responders.
Con Ed dispatched a team immediately to respond. As soon as the explosion was called in, FDNY responded literally within 2 minutes of the call for help.
Crisis talks over Ukraine will be held in London on Friday by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The two men will meet just 48 hours before a referendum is held in the Crimean Peninsula over whether the territory should become part of Russia. The G7 leaders have warned Russia that they will take further action individually and collectively if Crimea is annexed. The statement comes on the day that U.S. President Barack Obama met with Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk at the White House. Daniel Wrenches reports from Washington.
The G7 leaders are calling on Russia to stop supporting the intended referendum on Sunday, which could lead to the Crimea breaking away from Ukraine. Leaders from Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, the United States, the President of the European Council and the President of the European Commission call it illegal under the Ukrainian constitution and say given the intimidating presence of Russian troops, it would also be a deeply flawed process and they would not recognize it. They go on to state that Russian annexation would be a clear violation of a variety of international laws, though officials in Moscow argue that it's the government in Kiev, which is illegitimate.
Malaysia's transport minister has denied that confusion and chaos surround the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet, which disappeared on Saturday. Hishamuddin Hussein told a rowdy press conference in Kuala Lumpur that the search for the plane and the 239 people on board continued on both sides of the Malaysian peninsula. Malaysia's Air Force chief has denied that the plane was tracked by radar to the Malacca Strait in the west, which would have indicated it was flying in the wrong direction. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. British Prime Minister David Cameron is traveling to the Middle East to attempt to boost efforts to restart peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Mr. Cameron says peace efforts are at a critical phase. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
David Cameron says he wants to encourage Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to take the final difficult steps towards peace. He insists the prize of a stable Middle East with a sovereign Palestinian state living in peace alongside Israel is achievable. The Prime Minister is unlikely to deviate from the UK's usual position of acknowledging Israel's security concerns but also criticising the building of settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's Mr. Cameron's first visit to Israel as Prime Minister. Travelling with him is a business delegation seeking to encourage technology and innovation links between the UK and the region.
A British al-Qaeda operative testified in a U.S. federal court in New York City that he flew from Pakistan to Europe in 2001 with a bomb in his shoe before abandoning the mission. The operative, Sajid Badat, was testifying in the trial of one of Osama bin Laden's son-in-laws. Iris Spitzer reports from New York.
Badat pleaded guilty in Great Britain in 2005 for his role in the plot and began helping authorities in exchange for a shortened sentence. He was supposed to be the second person in a coordinated attack with convicted shoe bomber Richard Reid before backing out of the plan. Badat said he met with both Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the month leading up to the planned attack, which was supposed to take place a month after September 11, 2001. Prosecutors are using Badat's testimony to try and show that bin Laden's son-in-law Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, who is charged with conspiring to kill Americans, was aware of the mission. Badat joined the court via video from Great Britain because he refuses to come to the U.S., where he faces terrorism charges himself.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will meet Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in London on Friday for talks over the crisis in Ukraine. The news was announced as the interim Ukrainian Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, visited Washington for talks at the White House with President Obama. Meanwhile, leaders of the G7 warned Russia today against any move to annex Crimea. But there's every indication that a referendum in the peninsula will go ahead as planned on Sunday. With the details of all the latest developments, FSN's Simon Marks.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk's visit to Washington is heavy with symbolism, the Obama administration sending a clear message to Moscow that it stands by the interim government in Kiev, and in the case of President Obama at the White House, personally gives the 39-year-old prime minister the imprimatur of legitimacy to lead Ukraine out of its crisis.
We will continue to say to the Russian government that if it continues on the path that it is on, then not only us, but the international community, the European Union and others will be forced to apply a cost to Russia's encroachments on Ukraine.
But Mr. Yatsenyuk came to Washington not just looking for symbolic support. Ukrainian officials say the country has a mere $500,000 left in its treasury. And while the U.S. has already announced $1 billion in loan guarantees, the government in Kiev is looking for as much as $4 billion in international financial support just to prevent a default on its debts. Analyst Stephen Pfeiffer of the Washington-based Brookings Institution argues a financial rescue package could not only help shore up the interim government of Ukraine, but help Washington as well, as it penalizes Russia for its military incursion.
In a way, the best way to get revenge on what's happened, what the Russians have done last week, is if 3 or 4 years from now you look at Ukraine and say, hey, there's a country, the economy's turned around now, they're cleaning up corruption, they're growing. They have stable democratic institutions. It's looking a little bit more each day like Poland. I mean, that's the way to sort of stick a thumb in Vladimir Putin's eye.
There are voices here urging no financial support for Ukraine. Demonstrations took place today outside the White House, mounted by a coalition of left-leaning organizations who argue, like the Russian government, that Mr. Yatsenyuk is leading an illegitimate neo-fascist government. But inside the White House, spokesman Jay Carney again threw America's weight behind the interim authorities in Kiev.
We strongly support the Ukrainian people. We strongly support Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty. We strongly support and urge the effort underway in Congress to pass legislation that would provide bilateral assistance to Ukraine.
The White House says it is appropriate for Secretary of State John Kerry to travel to London on Friday for another round of face-to-face talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, even though Moscow has not agreed to the creation of a contact group on Ukraine. Mr. Kerry told a congressional committee on Wednesday morning that he still hopes negotiations can bring a breakthrough.
We will offer certain choices to Foreign Minister Lavrov and to President Putin through him and to Russia with hopes, and I think the hopes of the world, that we will be able to find a way forward that diffuses this.
But absent a crisis diffused, the White House is being urged by some policy analysts to get even tougher with Moscow.
I think you do have to make people pay a real price, even for things you're not prepared to go to war for.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow with Washington's Brookings Institution.
If Russia annexes Crimea in a week, there has to be a lasting pain. And I personally would not consider it to be a major international crisis that necessarily makes me sleep less well at night. But I think Russia has to suffer lasting consequences, especially Putin and his inner circle.
On Thursday, Ukraine's interim leader takes his campaign for support to New York. He'll address the United Nations, all part of a Washington-backed move to create the impression that the era of former Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych is firmly over. But with the stage still set for Sunday's referendum in Crimea over whether the peninsula should become part of Russia, the standoff over his country's future shows no sign of abating. Simon Marks, Washington.
And we'll have coverage of Prime Minister Yatsenyuk's visit to the United Nations in New York tomorrow. This is FSN Reports. Missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 may have been traced to an area south of Thailand's island of Phuket, hundreds of miles from its last known position. That's according to the head of the Malaysian Air Force. Authorities and experts are now attempting to verify this latest theory surrounding the direction taken by the airline. Day five of a widening search involving dozens of ships and aircraft has so far failed to locate anything linked to the Boeing 777 aircraft. 239 passengers and crew were on board Saturday's flight when communication was lost and the plane dropped from radar en route from Malaysia to Beijing. For more on why no breakthrough has yet been made, I spoke to filmmaker and author on the subject of air disasters, Robert Mattson.
What I'm seeing is that there is so much that's unknown that the searchers don't even know where to go. They don't know where to look. And even though they are expanding into ever broader patterns, I think that key facts are still missing, even for those who know as much as they know, just outside of what we can even reasonably grasp in terms of what the final moments of that flight were like.
Have we ever come close to something as baffling as this Malaysian Airlines flight?
Oh, sure. You don't have to look any further than off the coast of the United States to Florida, where five Army Air Force planes took off in 1945 and disappeared. A whole flight disappeared. These were planes flying in formation that disappeared off the coast of Florida. And then a giant rescue boat, a PBY rescue plane that was an amphibian, took off after them, and it disappeared too. And none of those six aircraft were ever found. No trace of them was ever found.
Broadly held expert opinion is that if the plane did break apart for whatever reason, there would be evidence of such in floating debris. Why do you think they're still struggling to find that? Is it as simple as that?
Well, I think that goes back to the fact that investigators don't know where to look. Because, yes, a plane that has a catastrophe at 35,000 feet is going to be scattered over a very large area, and some of it is going to sink. And some of it is going to float. And so once they find the first trace, I think that they are going to follow the currents and they're going to find a lot more. But they have to know where to look.
Air disasters stir primal human emotion in all of us and never fails to capture the attention of the media and the audience.
Oh, it's visceral. Yes, because we all step on aircraft. And it's the same thing that they felt in 1942. What I discovered in writing Fireball was that you got onto the plane because you had this faith in this mechanical contraption and the people operating it. But you always know in the back of your mind something can go wrong. And then you start to think about these poor passengers on the Malaysian flight. You think about, how would I react? Would I be conscious, you know, when I hit the water? How long would I be conscious? What would I go through? What did they go through? You know, those are universal questions, and we relate to every one of them.
Author and filmmaker Robert Mattson. Now, with Washington still reeling from public accusations that the Central Intelligence Agency spied on Senate staffers, the CIA has hit back with accusations of its own. In a letter released this week, they claim the Senate Intelligence Committee unlawfully obtained an internal CIA report on torture. The intergovernmental battle comes as civil liberties and privacy advocates say top senators are displaying hypocrisy as they've defended surveillance of the American people and are only now protesting because they themselves are the target. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ohlstein reports.
The two sides continue to lob accusations of legal violations related to a multi-year study of the agency's torture of detainees in secret prisons after the 9/11 attacks. A letter from CIA Director John Brennan leaked this week says sensitive CIA documents may have been improperly obtained and retained, referring to a secret report on torture called the Panetta Review, named after the CIA's former leader. But Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein said she believes her committee had every right to review and keep the documents they found.
What was unique and interesting about the internal documents was not their classification level, but rather their analysis and acknowledgement of significant CIA wrongdoing. To be clear, the committee staff did not hack into CIA computers to obtain these documents, as has been suggested in the press. The documents were identified using the search tool provided by the CIA to search the documents provided to the committee. We have no way to determine who made the internal Panetta review documents available to the committee. Further, we don't know whether the documents were provided intentionally by the CIA, unintentionally by the CIA, or intentionally by a whistleblower.
Feinstein added that because of the CIA's history of destroying evidence of its own wrongdoing, including videotapes of detainees undergoing torture at offshore black sites, her committee staff printed copies of the document, took them back to the Capitol, and locked them in a safe. Feinstein said she wanted to make sure the document wasn't shredded or buried because it supports her own committee's criticisms of the torture program. But many civil liberties and privacy advocates are criticizing Feinstein for her efforts this week because of her past history of supporting government surveillance. Local activist Allie McCracken was one of a small group protesting outside Senator Feinstein's Capitol Hill office on Wednesday, calling for CIA Director John Brennan to be fired and for Feinstein to take a stronger stand against all warrantless surveillance.
Well, I mean, she's been a hawkish supporter of the NSA. She's supposed to be regulating the NSA, but instead she's just turned out to be their cheerleader. She doesn't find it constitutionally offensive to spy on Americans, but all of a sudden, you know, she's outraged about the potential of her security being breached. And so it's very hypocritical.
Former government contractor Edward Snowden, who began leaking evidence of mass government spying last summer, echoed this sentiment in a statement released this week. He said Feinstein does not care at all that the rights of millions of ordinary citizens are violated by our spies, but suddenly it's a scandal when a politician finds out the same thing happens to them. In Washington, I'm Alice Ohlstein.
After nearly 30 years on death row in Louisiana, Glenn Ford has won his freedom after new evidence cleared him of any involvement in the murder of a jeweler in 1983. Mr. Ford, who was released from Angola prison on Tuesday, has always denied any role in the robbery and murder of Isidore Roseman. Earlier, I spoke to Tanjaywe McHarris, senior campaigner with Amnesty International, who told me Glenn Ford had literally fought for his life.
We commend the work of Glenn Ford's attorneys to bring justice home to him. And most of all, we applaud Glenn Ford, who for the past three decades has been fighting literally for his life. Glenn Ford, three decades ago, was convicted and sentenced to death for robbery and murder. And in 2000, the Louisiana Supreme Court ordered an evidentiary hearing on the basis of the claim that the prosecution during his trial suppressed evidence that implicated another individual as being involved or responsible for the crime that took place. And so now what we've what we've seen is the current prosecutors moved to vacate the charges, moved to have him released on the basis of what they called credible evidence that Glenn Ford not only did not commit the crime, but also did not participate and was not even present. And so what you have is a man who spent 30 years on death row, went in his 30s, and left in his 60s, becoming a survivor of death row.
Tanjiwe, I read somewhere today the case of Mr. Ford described as a happy ending to a very sad story. But how do you think a man in that position, someone who has sat on death row awaiting execution for so many years, aware of his innocence, how will he come to terms with his freedom and the psychological burden of the injustice?
You know, I think that question is best answered by Mr. Ford and also his attorneys. But if to understand the psychological and also physical impact that living on death row, waiting for a day that somebody will come and give you a death warrant that tells you the moment your life is going to be taken, the impact that has on the individual and thousands of individuals that are currently on death row is beyond, I think, what many of us are able to articulate.
Tanjiwe McHarris, senior campaigner with Amnesty International. Now to South America, where Chileans have a new president. Michelle Bachelet returns to power, first having served as president from 2006 to 2010. This time round, the Socialist Party politician will be working hand in hand with the student movement. Earlier today, our FSN Español correspondent Andrea Arenas spoke with political analyst and editor of InfoAmericas.com, Patricio Zamorano, who explained what this second Michelle Bachelet victory means for Chile.
Michelle Bachelet means continuity, the continuation of the social policies that she was trying to implement when she was president before. So she's going to continue with those reforms that the middle class in Chile demands urgently, mainly education, tax reform. We have to remember that the middle class has huge expectations after the end of the dictatorship 30 years ago.
Can you explain the influence that the student movement has had in Chilean politics?
We have to remember that President Piñera, the right-wing leader that governed Chile for the last 4 years, he has to face huge pressure from the student movement in Chile, especially during 2011. Students were on the streets protesting intensely about the lack of quality for public education. That's something that is coming from the dictatorship. We have to remember that the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, he basically privatized a big area of the public education system. So the educational movement actually hit Piñera very, very strong, and we can explain a little bit the comeback of President Bachelet as an answer against Piñera and his policies.
Will it be easy for Michelle Bachelet to govern with the newly appointed Congress, which now includes four former students?
Well, it's not only that. The students or the former students, including Camila Vallejo, who was the leader, she was an excellent leader of the movement for a couple of years, very known in the rest of the planet. She's a congresswoman now. But the important issue here is most of the students who became congressmen now, they are from the Communist Party. The Communist Party now is part of Bachelet's coalition, which is big news for the history of Chile, because we have to remember that the dictatorship was basically organized or put in place against the Socialist Party, which is the party of President Bachelet, and the Communist Party. In that sense, it's very interesting, the change of history, where we have now the Communist Party being part of the coalition. At the same time, they are not only congressmen, they are former student leaders.
Patricio Zamorano. Now, one of Britain's most colourful union leaders has died. leading to tributes from across the political spectrum. Bob Crowe was the leader of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, and therefore the man many Londoners would blame for disruption caused by a tube strike just last month. He frequently clashed with political leaders and was ridiculed by much of the British media. But on his death, many of his erstwhile opponents have been admitting their admiration for a towering, if often unpopular, figure. He died of a suspected heart attack. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
It's only demonstrations and marching feet that changed history.
Bob Crowe was a union leader of the old school, in charge of the RMT union from 2002. He'd started work on the London Underground at the age of 16, fixing rails and cutting down trees by the track. He devoted his life to the railways, and latterly to the members of his union. At times, that made him the nemesis of London's Conservative Mayor Boris Johnson. Mr. Johnson displayed a reluctance to meet Mr. Crowe in person, so the ever-creative union leader took to calling him on a radio phone-in on London's LBC.
What I can't do, and I think listeners will understand this, I can't sit down and negotiate with you, let alone negotiate with you on air, when you're holding a gun to Londoners' heads and threatening disruption in the greatest city on earth.
Nonetheless, on his death at the age of just 52, Boris Johnson was one of many political leaders willing to pay tribute.
He was obviously a man who stuck up for his views, who had very, very strong principles. I didn't necessarily share those views. I'm not a Marxist or whatever by any stretch of the imagination. But what I admired was his indefatigable defence of what he thought of as his members' views and his members' interests.
Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government of the 1980s devoted huge amounts of political capital to breaking the stranglehold of the industrial unions on Britain. And the last Labour government went to great pains to demonstrate it was not in the pocket of the unions. But Dan Hodges of The Telegraph, a former communications director at Transport for London, which runs the Tube, says Bob Crowe was a union leader who deserved the respect he's now being shown.
A number of people regard Bob Crowe as quite a divisive figure, and I think, there's an element of that. But one thing's for certain, the members appreciated precisely what he did for them. His only focus was what he could deliver for his members in terms of their pay and their conditions.
In the media, Bob Crowe was often a figure of fun, but he was normally happy to play along with the fun, such as during this appearance on the BBC's comedy quiz show, Have I Got News For You?
We just have to stop now, because Bob has negotiated a 10-minute tea break. So
25 years ago, everyone would have got a cup of tea.
You're working.
Now he's on his own.
Mr. Crowe was criticised by the right-wing media for being a union leader who would push his members into strikes over pay and conditions while being paid well over $200,000 a year himself. He would be pictured sunning himself in the Caribbean or Brazil. And on LBC, he was vilified for still living in local authority-supported council housing while earning far above the average wage.
I think it's so deeply morally wrong and repugnant. I'm shocked.
So you're telling me, my daughters and sons, they've all got to leave home and find somewhere else to live.
Yeah.
All because I live there. So you're gonna.
You know what they should say. They should say, weren't we lucky that when our dad was at his lowest point in life, there was a government, there were taxpayers who were subsidising our housing.
Can I tell you something? Weren't we lucky?
And let's give something back now, and let's leave that home
and give that home
to somebody who needs it more than us. That's exactly what they should do.
But there was always a grudging respect for a man not frightened to stick to his guns.
You can hound me to the day I die. I'm not changing. I'm going to defend my members and fight for what's right in this country.
Ollie Barrett, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can email us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Thursday, our coverage of the visit of Ukraine's interim prime minister continues. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.